welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Chuck Hoff. And he will be speaking on how we know what isn't so. So let's listen in on Chuck Hoff.
You saw the homework or weight work that I put up. And I think that is one of the first things I want us to do. But before we do that, I want to introduce myself and talk about sort of what it is that I'm doing, which is being confused about my chair right now. What I am is a social psychologist. My name's Chuck Hoff. A lot of people call me Chucky. That's perfectly fine if you'd like to call me Chucky. It's in the South, the diminutive is not thought of as making light of someone. It's simply thought of as familiar, being friendly with them. So Chucky Hoff is fine. What social psychologists do is study how people interact with each other, how people perceive and think about each other, and how that works itself out in social groups and also in how people think about themselves. So I've been doing that for quite a while now. I've also piddled in theology and philosophy in various graduate programs along the way. It's been a long, strange trip. Ended up in Minnesota, South Georgia boy in Minnesota. One of the things I want to make clear at first is that I'm not trained as a clinical psychologist. I don't have the training to help people in depth with their personal problems. I'm a nice guy and a good listener, and if you'd like to talk to me about them, I'll be glad to talk to you. But because I'm called a psychologist doesn't mean I'm a particular expert at that. My training lies elsewhere, and that's looking at how people interact with each other. The theme for this week is how we think about other people. Next week we're going to do more talking about interaction and groups and social conflict, those sorts of things. But this week, a lot of it is about what goes on up in our heads as we're looking at other people. What you can expect from the kinds of things that I hope to bring out is some practice in how to think more carefully about other people and about other people's motivations. I can't promise you any answers about the right way to think about other people. Partly because situations vary so widely, and partly because this stuff is so complex, and psychologists have only been looking at it really carefully and empirically for about 50 years. Part of what I want to bring us to is a more complex way of thinking about other people and of thinking about how we think about, did that work? Thinking about how we think about other people. So instead of saying there's good ways and there's bad ways, I hope, in fact, to confuse you a little about that. So having said that, if you have done your homework, I hope we've got a couple of stories that people can share about first impressions that they might have had of individuals and place, and how those first impressions perhaps led you astray. And if you do, I'd like to hear a few of them now. This is sort of grist for the mill.
Well, when I was in college, there was a guy who I immediately took to be very cold and unfeeling. And you know, 20 years later, he's a very dear friend and one of the warmest people I know. So,
yeah.
Initial perception.
Can you remember back to your initial perception and the situation it was in? Is it suitable for public consumption?
Okay. it was a dinner. He was living with three other guys, one of whom was a friend of mine, and I came over to their house for dinner. And all through the meal, he just sort of treated me as I saw it, sort of ignored me and his reaction to anything I said was basically negative or in some way disapproving.
Right.
The way I perceived it.
Right. Yeah. And so this was in a dinner situation, and he was introduced to you from by a mutual friend.
By a mutual friend. That's right.
Okay.
And that evening, and then for the next two or three times I would run into him, you know, he had this look on his face that I interpreted as a scowl, I guess is the best way to put it. As a matter of fact, that's the way he looks today. Now his beard is gray rather than brown, but, yeah.
And still has a scowl.
He still has a scowl, same scowl.
But as far as you can tell, a warm person.
Absolutely, one of the warmest people I know, yeah.
Other folks have stories about this kind of thing? Yes.
Speaking of scowl, when I was in seventh grade, my homeroom teacher became very angry with me for scowling at her. She was asking something or I was asking something. I can't remember the entire situation now. But my normal look when I'm thinking looks like a scowl.
Yes.
And she just dressed me down good. But I tried to explain to her that I was just thinking. But she took it for, you know, being insolent or something.
Yes. But teacher, this is just my face.
Unfortunately. And I look the same way today. You know, I kind of wear my hair down over the... I just always look, you know, whenever I'm thinking.
Right.
Don't I look like a scowl?
Yeah.
I'm just
thinking. Well, I was about to sit in your glasses. Whoa.
I know. It's hard to know when I'm really scowling.
Yeah, and I have the sort of deep-set eyes and that make students think that I'm disapproving of them often when I'm simply just thinking. I'm going like this. And they're going, oh, he thinks I've done something wrong. Do we have some other stories? Yes.
Sure, after my best one happened right here at Holden, and I arrived here, this was a few years ago, and was sat down for the very first meal. And I was tired, I traveled, it was a hot day, I wanted to be left alone, and this person who was sitting next to me, some just kind of a little guy who was opening to the table, trying to make conversation, and my response was, you know, if you just be quiet, leave me alone, you know, I don't want to tell you where I'm from, what I do, you know, the usual,
yes.
I didn't want to care about anything to do with it, and my goal for the week was to avoid this person. And it turned out that not only was he one of the lecturers, but probably the most brilliant, you know, and learned intellectual people I've ever encountered in my life.
Yeah.
And it was a very humbling experience.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, as you say, that you were going to avoid him for the rest of the week, because one of the things that would end up doing is giving you no more information about that person. So you'd walk away with only that one impression. if they didn't happen to be on teaching staff. We've got time perhaps for one more story, if folks have one more story about how they've been misperceived or they misperceived other people. Yes.
I have another side. I have a colleague that, in a teaching situation, that dears everybody, and I just, and Don, I use that, and Dottie dear, and all of, I mean, I just thought she ingratiated herself, and I thought she was going to be trustworthy.
Well, yes.
And found out that probably I met a man in the body that blew a sword inside. Like this woman could do.
Right.
Behind your back and then to your face in front of other students. And then turn and be the deer again 2 months later and play everyone like that. I mean, it took probably 6 years for me to really see the picture. I feel real sad. He's more of
Yes. And so this was an initial positive impression.
Oh, yes.
That then you get more information and find out that that person's pattern of interaction really isn't what you had expected. Yeah.
You want a story the other way around?
Sure. You got a good one?
Well, yeah.
All right.
There was something that just didn't witness with my spirit about Jimmy, what's his name? On TV. The
Baker.
Ah.
Baker.
Yeah.
Lots of Jimmys on TV.
I really love it.
I was living with a roommate who thought he was just great. So when she'd have the program on, I would simply go in my bed and just not be around it. And then not too long after this, you know, he was shown to everyone before what he was really was.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, okay, it was God helping me to discernment of spirits, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, he's getting out of jail this week, isn't he?
He's in a halfway house.
He's in a halfway house, okay.
You know, he's so good at that he'll probably just do it again.
Yes. Are there other stories of times when it's worked?
I shouldn't be judgmental.
Well, part of what I'm going to say later is that we all are. Are there other stories of sort of initial impressions that worked later?
My wife.
Lovely.
I get a lot of points for that.
Yeah, that's right.
He's there one too.
See, part of the point that I wanted to make with having stories that run both ways is that it's not that it's bad to have first impressions. In fact, it's impossible not to have them. You're gonna have them. No matter what you do, you will have first impressions. And part of what I want to talk about today is how to be a little more careful about how we do first impressions. So part of the how we know what isn't so, or the more particular how we know what isn't so kind of thing I want to talk about, is how we do this when we do first impressions. For now, just to get started, I want to use just a little bit of psycho jargon, because it's useful. It's not too difficult. One of the commonalities that we see in all of these stories, some of them are, and in some of the stories, they both of these things jump out at you, and in other stories, one of them is hidden, is an interaction where there's a little bit of information, so a person who's a little cold, or perhaps a person who has interpersonal mannerisms that suggest endearment, and so you have some small amount of data on the one hand, and on the other hand you have theories about what that data means. And our theories about what that data mean are, for us, really implicit. That is, they're inside. I want to talk some more about this because it's really important to understand. But those theories that we have that help us to parse, to understand that little bit of data, are really what makes this whole system go. When you first saw this person who acted this way, you had a theory or some assumptions about how that worked and about the kind of personality you could expect long term from a person who acted that way in an interaction. The same with Deer and the same with Jim Baker. So we have two things here working. One is the little bit of data that we go on in a first impression, and the other one is the mill or the theory that we grind that stuff through to get an impression. And the kinds of suggestions I'm going to come up with at the end of the hour really address both of those issues, both the theories and the data. And we're going to have to think about both of those if we want to be better in how we do our first impressions of people. Now for the psychojargon. Schema is a word that psychologists use a lot to describe these theories. I like the word schema partly because it isn't as grandiose as theory. It doesn't suggest that I've sat down and written it out and have thought deeply about it. Schema suggests a sort of lighthearted theory that is just, well, yeah, I kind of think I know how that works. So that's why I like to use that word instead of things like theories, because theories sound much more full-blown, well thought out. Schemas for psychologists really are collections of expectations, assumptions, emotions that we have that are associated with particular things in the world. It doesn't have to just be interpersonal. We all have schemas about, for instance, chairs. We know what a chair is, and there's lots of things that look like chairs that can serve as chairs, and lots of things that don't, that can still serve as chairs. We use tree stumps as chairs. And you have a kind of a schema about chairs. Now, if you were a furniture maker, you might even have a theory about chairs. But you do have a kind of scheme about what a chair is like. Some chairs have arms, some don't. Some are high, some are low, some have trays in front of them. My schema of chairs will be forever changed because last summer I was a waitry here at Holden and I handled many, many chairs. So I think about them a little differently now. These schemas, just like we were talking about earlier with theories, work like filters for the data. But the important thing to note about these schemas is that they're easy to use, they work really quickly, and they're invisible to us. We generally don't think about our theories about other people. And it's these two qualities that are both their strength and their weakness. I mean, after all, if every time we met someone here at Holden, we had to go into deep meditation to get a first impression of them, you wouldn't make it from here to the dining hall. It'd take you 2 days and another 2 weeks to get out of the dining hall. So we've got to have sort of quick ways of thinking about other people. It's really important. Here's another example. We have some schemas about what uniforms mean on people. And if you're in a city and you're lost and you see somebody with a uniform, you usually think that's the kind of person who might be more willing to help you than just the standard person on the street. Blue uniforms are even better. Yeah.
I've noticed that people at Fulton tend to know their Myers and Briggs. Maybe when you arrive, they could issue a T-shirt and you could bring those four letters on your back.
Front and back.
So if you were seeking out or to avoid one of those, you know what to do.
Especially the avoid part.
Yes, and then people could play great tricks by trading T-shirts. But in fact, what you're talking about is the Myers...
It would be a kind of uniform.
Yeah, you're talking about the Myers-Briggs, really, as a schema that people use to filter other folks through.
And my schema might challenge, am I looking at the real McCoy, or is this guy switched?
That's right.
Now that you brought it up.
Some of the problems, though, with it, so the point there is that it's really important for us to have these things, and it's important for them to be invisible and really easy to use, because otherwise we'd spend all our time thinking about other people. We wouldn't be able to get through a day. But the fact that they're invisible and easy to use also can be a real danger, precisely because we don't think about them. We can't then change them if we get incorrect data or if we make an incorrect inference. We can't go back and make a change. A lot of the kinds of things that sessions here at Holden are about is helping you to think carefully about the schemas that you have, either about your Christianity or about other people or about issues of justice in the world. So part of what we're doing here at Holden is working on our schemas.
I couldn't hear you clearly. Were you saying that we can go back and change them or cannot?
The ones that we know about are easier to change. And the ones that we don't know about, to the extent that they are more invisible and much easier to use, they're harder to change because they go back into the woodwork. Now, let me give you an example about a really invisible schema that I think all of us have. And it has some great work that Paul Rosen has done in psychology on the concept of disgust. I wish I could have done this work because it was just fun to do. Making little chocolate bars that look like doggy doo-doo. and saying, would you rather have this or this chocolate bar? Let me give you one of the kinds of examples that Rosen does in his public lectures. In all of our mouths right now is saliva. It's a useful thing. We use it both for lubrication, makes it easier to talk, and we also use saliva for a sort of pre-digestion. Right now, you're all, I suspect, pretty aware of just how much saliva is in your mouth and its particular texture. And we could go into a long discourse on the texture of saliva, but we won't do it. Yum. Now, I want you to think about taking the saliva that you have and spitting it out into a glass. It all of a sudden becomes a very different kind of thing. Now it's stuff that's outside of your mouth instead of in it. And who would think that you would then drink it again? Okay, we got some disgust. Good. That's what I was looking for. With little children, disgust, and those of you who are parents know this, is a learned thing.
Emily just came in here to show me something that was really funny. Disgusting. She and her little friend took me up to the bathroom, and they filled their mouths with water and opened the toilet and went bleh into the toilet and spit the water. And they thought that was the funniest thing. I was disgusted. Did you tell her that was disgusting? Did your teacher? No, I just said I wanted her to find something more interesting to do.
Yes. But with little children, disgust is a learned thing. They think that poop is just wonderful stuff. They go, wow, look at this. It's Play-Doh, and I made it. And one of the things that we do is train little children what they ought to be disgusted about. And it's very useful to train people what they ought to be disgusted about, because otherwise, flu runs around the village. but notice that to you, your disgust when I did the saliva monologue felt very natural. It felt like that was precisely the right thing to feel. And it was almost as though every sane person would feel that way.
Well, yeah.
And there are differences of opinion, by the way, about saliva in different countries.
Which one do you want to go?
I don't want to go there.
That's right.
But your immediate reaction makes you think that that it is a fact that saliva is disgusting, as opposed to something that you learned. And because of that, now I think it's good to think saliva is disgusting. I'm a well-socialized American, so I would agree with you that it's a good thing to think it is. But the example points out that, in fact, it really is a learned thing. It is not something naturally occurring. Because if it were a naturally occurring thing, you would expect that little children wouldn't like it, too.
And they do like to spit into the glass and drink it, yeah. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, no, not that one. But they do find a lot of things fascinating that we find disgusting.
They don't find it disgusting.
They don't find it quite
as five. Well, Emily would think it was disgusting, but too. Laura would spit her milk back in her glass and drink it again.
Yeah.
I mean, she wouldn't find anything.
It just wasn't that big a deal.
Yeah,
right. So, but the nature of our understanding of disgust is so hidden to us and invisible because we learn it so early and we learn it so well that it is hard to change it. So if you go to another country and find, for instance, people in India are just horrified that you would blow your nose into a handkerchief and put it in your pocket, for God's sake. How disgusting. They'd rather walk over to the side of the road and go, right? Because you don't want to keep that. God, you're saving it for later? This will make for some fascinating dinner conversation, I know.
My roommate finally told me
last Saturday. And it seemed to come up at dinner every time, you know, around our meals. And I would end up telling when I threw up in relation to when the people from Iowa came and it wasn't their fault. You know, and she finally said, quit talking about that when we're eating.
Yes.
And when have I heard that before?
So, but the sort of take-home point for our discussion of this is that here's a reaction that feels very natural, that it's in fact learned. Your reaction to your friend, who seemed cold and distant, felt very natural. So it seemed to you, it's just a fact that he's cold and distant. And so the two work the same in that way, that they're very easy to use and they're invisible to us. You didn't go through the inference process, this person creases their eyebrows a lot and they look away from me and they say bad things, therefore they must hate me. You just said, gosh, what a cold and distant person. And it felt like the truth. If it's like that, you then get this feeling of truthness to your perceptions. Does that make sense? You know, and some of you still are convinced that saliva is disgusting, and you know that people who act in a certain way just must be that way. We have this problem all the time when I try to talk about nonverbal interaction, because we learn to read nonverbal cues so well in particular cultures. We were talking about this earlier before class. We learn to read them so well that it just seems natural to think that a particular kind of facial expression should necessarily mean that a person thinks this way about you.
One of the things that impacted and happened at home last year, we have this little grandson that is now 3.5, but last year he was 2.5, and he so fell in love with a little girl named Marla, who was 6 years old. Traced after her everywhere she was until the last day, and 6 months later, when he is 3, we're talking about Holy Village at the table, and he says, "And Martha," I said, "Hi," and Martha goes, he knew that the rolling of the eyes, the flipping of the hand, meant, I don't like you. I don't have anything to do with you. It had so affected him.
Yes.
That he had not, I mean, he still imagined that look. It's
yes.
All he could remember about it.
Yeah. And perhaps about Holden Village.
Now he's back. So we're glad Martha isn't here. So it's Martha. Yeah, I'm sure. But you wonder, and then nobody really—it wasn't something he just taught.
And this, I think, is the danger, though, of these first impressions that we get, is they feel so truthful. And they feel so factual. Partly because they are so automatic, just like our disgust reaction. And they can then last with us forever and lead us to never interact with a person again. And never then give that person a chance to prove to you that they're not that way, or perhaps that they really are that way. One of the things that I want to do is to
talk. The gal that didn't find out for 6 years sure gave plenty of chance.
Well, we as people who are maybe creating a first impression are very conscious of that, I think, too. We're subconscious of it because we do certain things when we're looking for a job or going to a social event.
I must tell you, I did not look like this. I did not look like this when I went for my job interview at St. Olaf College. My hair was much shorter. And we do these kind of managements of impressions. But our management is based on theories. And this is where sometimes intercultural conversations break down because theories differ from culture to culture. In addition, our theories about what people think may in fact be wrong. Even in our own culture, we may think that a long stare means one thing to a person, but that person may think it means something very different. And a lot of it depends upon the situation that that person is in. But yes, you're right. Precisely what we do is, since we know other people are doing this all the time, we do a lot of impression management. Yeah, it's foremost on a lot of people's minds. One of the things that I wanted to do was to talk about what it is that psychologists know about these schemas that we use to understand people, and how that then affects the way that we think about others. This is a bit of a laundry list. We could scramble it and start at the bottom. But I wanted to start at the top, partly because I think that the one that's at the top has a very interesting implication. The schemas that we use, or the boxes that we use to stick people into and to make inferences about them, are not at the level of the dialogue that we have here at Holden Village about prejudice. When we have a dialogue about prejudice or about justice at Holden Village, we talk about African Americans and European Americans. Or we talk about women and men. The research that's been done on the schemas that people use to think about others suggests that we don't use that level of category. Instead, I wrote some down here. Instead, we think when we think about women, we think about things like a career woman, or a housewife, or a feminist. And when we think of a feminist, then a whole bunch of associations all of a sudden tumble in. And if you watch yourself while you're thinking about other people, you can feel this happen to you. You don't, when you hear that she's a woman, say, oh yeah, I know what she's like. But when you hear she's a feminist, you go, oh yeah, I know all about feminists. Or when you hear she's a housewife, all of a sudden you make three or four or five or six inferences. If in fact this is the level or the place where we keep our schemas and we make a lot of our inferences, it suggests that our dialogue about how to change the way we think needs to be at this level, instead of at the level of women versus men. Does that make sense? Because if you're going to change your schemas, you've got to work directly on the schemas that you have, instead of work on these more global schemas. So I can be perfectly correct about what I think about women, and I can have a fine discussion with you about women and be convinced to myself that I have thought this out well and that I'm not prejudiced at all.
But when I hear that someone is a radical feminist, then all of a sudden, boom, I make a whole bunch of inferences.
Chuck, you're making a sort of a big generalization, and but you do qualify by saying at Holden, you make an assumption about the kind of people who are here, but there are other contexts within which women or African American or Jew or whatever, depending on the level of experience somebody may have, might not hold that as a universal schema, but as a particular one.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So, for instance, we do not, as a rule, have very much interaction, or at least those of us in the Midwest, those of you here on the West Coast are probably different, have very much interaction with people who are Oriental. So if you don't have very much interaction with people who are Oriental, Oriental may be the level that I think about people at, and that may be the level that I make all of these inferences at. And it's only later that I get better at being prejudiced, and I'm prejudiced against particular kinds of Orientals. I think, Koreans, instead of saying all Orientals.
Don't you think too that we engage in discussions at the level that we're comfortable with, right? Because it's not the level that we're struggling with.
I like that point. That's a very good point, which is that I may be perfectly willing to talk about women because that's not the level that most catches me when I am going to be prejudiced against a particular kind of woman. And so it can, again, the idea that our schemas can come at these different levels suggests that we need to be very careful in our dialogue about justice or about prejudice in order really to address the place where the prejudice lives instead of simply to talk in these big categories. It is true and almost trivially true that these levels are going to differ from person to person and differ because of experience. I mean, my example just a little while ago, I do not have very much experience with Orientals because I am from the Midwest where there aren't as many as there are in the West Coast. There are a whole variety of reasons that the level that I think about and categorize people at would be different from the level you do. But I think it really has some implications for how we do our conversation when we are talking about issues of justice. Another issue, and this is one that came up, I think, in a lot of the comments that people make, is that we rely really heavily on visual cues. I'm going to give you one example of where visual cues greatly influence things of great importance, and that's in the court system. You realize in the court system, a good-looking defendant has a much better chance of being found innocent. This is why defense lawyers have gotten worked up about making sure that their clients can appear well-dressed rather than in their prison clothes. A baby-faced person is much less likely to be convicted of a crime unless the crime involves something that kicks in thinking about an innocent-looking person who might deceive you. So these very surface-level visual cues, baby-faced, good-looking,
the kinds of things that we carry with us. When I walk downtown, it's clear to people that I'm a kind of professional because of the bag that I carry. It's not a real attaché case, so I'm not an upper-class professional. And I'm probably, if you look at the fact that I have blue jeans on and a button-down shirt and long hair, well, that's probably an academic. By the way, I thought about this as I decided how I would dress. And that gets back to the issue of impression management.
Blue jeans would make you appear to be an academic.
Yes. Blue, and when I go to conventions, I wear a tweed jacket with my blue jeans.
Right.
Yes, tweed jackets for men.
Changed since my day.
Yes. Yes. Now those are kind of the signs. A tweed jacket is very important. I have two. One for summer and one for winter.